Okay, so I mentioned that mid-century, Wesley's, Whitfield's, parted over theology. Whitfield, not that this is his only black mark, certainly he's a fallible human being like everybody else, but he really does emerge as someone that most people from different stripes really have a lot of admiration for, and rightly so. And yet, there was some naivete. As we mentioned, Whitfield did not become a Calvinist because Edwards got him in a headlock once he got to America. Not true. He was already seeing, not only embracing the doctrines of grace, but seeing them more and more and more on his journey over for practical reasons. But at any rate, he had these effects in England. He keeps coming for more trips to America. But Whitfield's health declined in the final decade, namely 1760s. And he frequently vomited blood. And you're waiting for this because the guy is speaking to crowds of 30, 40,000 nine times a week without the help of modern microphones, megaphones, amphitheaters, and so on. And he just, it's a gift, but it does take a toll. And legend has it, actually, that a group of Englishmen would assemble around the church that he would preach at, mocking him. One man in particular had perfected his impersonation of Whitfield outside in the alley. And he would stand up on the box and start being Whitfield and mocking him, drunken with all of his other drunk friends. Until one night, it reached such a state of perfect mimicking that this man who was mocking Whitfield fell under the influence of the Holy Spirit and was converted while he gave the phony gospel call. Now, whatever truth there is in that story, we do know that several plays were written and performed in Britain making sport of Whitfield while he was ill. With the French and Indian War now over, in 1763, he traveled to America one more time. And in his stay in Connecticut, he was able to help promote the friend of Edwards, Reverend Wheelock's new school, and secured the grant of one Lord Dartmouth, and thus the fourth Ivy League school expressly created by Puritans for the Puritan vision of Christianity was born. Whitfield was determined to appeal to Englishmen in 1765 to found a similar college in Georgia. Yet the authorities at Canterbury would not, unless it was an Anglican school, which Whitfield refused. He would return to America for a final time in 1769 to found the College of Georgia himself. Construction began, but so did another evangelistic tour. Many of the crowds were as large as a generation before, which gives us pause to consider that the same basic gospel was heard and understood by the generation that went to war with Britain. So it's important because a lot of deists from the South and the Middle Colonies, and we'll talk about that in a second, but yet the generation that grew up, for example, John Adams and Samuel Adams, these were the children of Congregational Puritans during the Great Awakening, not just some late Puritanism. And so that had to have effect, no matter how many deists they hung out with. So let's not fly to the other extreme and say, well, they were just a bunch of deists. That's not completely true. So he's up there with this another gospel circuit in the 1760s. And this was the year, 1769, before those intolerable acts toward the colonies would push them over the edge toward the revolution. There is evidence that Whitfield would have sided with the Americans had he lived a little bit longer. On September 29th, 1770, in Boston, he preached a two-hour sermon, went to the pastor's home that night, and went to sleep. Woke up at 2 in the morning, thinking himself refreshed, and saying to the young man in the house, "A good pulpit sweat today may give me relief. I shall be better after preaching." But 2 hours later, he awoke being unable to breathe, and he died 3 hours later, staying alive as long as he did, only in order to preach one more time. Now, what became of the Wesleys and the Methodism which they now superintended? Well, the first value of Wesley's theology was that it did not allow for a carnal Christianity in our initial definitions of who's a Christian and what is a Christian life. He began his critique of modern Christendom when he was at Oxford, allowing only a Christian who was filled with the Holy Spirit and manifested his spiritual fruit. But Wesley had a market ready to address. There was already a middle ground among the English who would not hear of either Puritanism on the one hand or all-out skepticism on the other hand. A few books that made an impact on this demographic and on Wesley from the previous generation were Jeremy Taylor's Holy Living and Holy Dying and the aforementioned Henry Scougal's Life of God and the Soul of Man, which was so instrumental in Whitfield's conversion. And then two books by a guy named William Law, Christian Perfection in 1726 and A Serious Call to a Devout Life in 1728. So here, in a mixture that was informed by his learned mother, Susanna, as much as anybody else, there is a spirit-infused Anglican view that didn't have to resort to Calvinism in order to evoke the supernatural. So you see this as sort of this have your cake and eat it too. It is a supernaturalism of sorts still, but not with all that Calvinism stuff. Now, the theological mutiny of Wesley to the crowds that had been gathered by Whitfield alone does not explain the growth of Methodism. Wesley would find many who felt as he did. Like many before them, they could not stomach the doctrines of the Reformation, but they could not bear to think that this left them with atheism. However, now, in the new English atmosphere of tolerance, there was nothing to fence their theological exploration in, and it was a situation which would only be exacerbated by the commercial possibilities of the American frontier. With Wesley's evangelistic and organizational success came his dismissal of theology. He was an academic by nature, and even his own followers would recognize his sermons as dry by modern standards, so that he was an eloquent logic chopper when you read his sermons today. But in spite of being an academic, when it suited him, he would readily turn against systematic thinking. For instance, his famous quote that, quote, "Religion is the most plain thing, the most simple thing in the world. We love him because he first loved us. So far as you add philosophy to religion, just so far you spoil it," end quote. Now, that was a clever card trick that perhaps Wesley himself did not realize he was performing, but which the modern Christian would become inundated with. Keep it simple. We love because he first loved us. But if you ask whether or not that means that God's love came first, that and that alone is to, quote, add philosophy. So to say to me, can you say that in different words? Oh, you're reading into Scripture Greek speculative categories of thought. Now, Wesley was quite an academic. And Wesley even had said at one point that the minister that does not master logic hasn't really gone very far, and he's no minister at all. Well, that's good. But when it suited him, he was against systematic thinking. At any rate, after an initial hope that converts of the revival preaching would simply be welcomed into the Church of England, the Wesleys had to consider that the church was not what the state said that it was after all. He would build upon that society model that was already begun by 1739, and as late as 1784, when Wesley sat in on an Anglican sermon, he heard the total denouncing of his Methodists. Until the end, his conviction was that this was not meant to be a separate church. But in time, the societies began to take up collections and administer discipline. In fact, they were doing everything that churches do. And they began to call these classes, which is a word that was already used in Reformed and Lutheran circles. And yet a hierarchy began to develop, with the most elite group being called a select society. And he started to have, 12 rules of discipline, 4 ministers, and then it became what all churches become. It was in 1784 when a deed of declaration constituted the Methodist churches more officially. And by the end of the decade, ministers were being ordained across the English-speaking world. Now, in America, the first Methodist society was present by 1766. And a decade later, in the midst of war, there were over 3,000 members, still not many by comparison. Their first bishop in America was named Francis Asbury, and Asbury's dates are 1745 to 1816. And he has a seminary named after him in Central Florida, actually, and I think a publishing house as well among the Methodists. But he had his work cut out for him, because Wesley had openly opposed the Revolution, which made the Methodists initially unpopular, and they had to kind of go into hiding. But the post-war missionary efforts of Asbury largely reversed this. So what you have in the 1770s and 80s especially is a westward push to the frontier, which meant, so glad we have this map now, which meant out here. So the borders of, so you're talking about the Allegheny Mountains and this whole area, and even going as far as Kentucky and Tennessee. So Daniel Boone territory out there. But you had these preachers going out there, and some congregations eventually would learn to do it better than others, or some groups. So the Baptists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterian initially appeared to have equal zeal and equal representation in evangelizing that push through the Appalachian region during the 1770s and 80s. But that would change with Presbyterianism cooling off. Each group saw this as a furtherance of the Great Awakening, and each wanted to bear its own doctrinal stamp upon it. But it was the efforts of Asbury that really outstripped all of them. As he preached throughout Tennessee and Kentucky in the frontier, some 16,500 sermons, and ordained 4,000 preachers. The Methodists won the frontier from the beginning because they would ordain from any social rank, and therefore their horseback circuit preachers would move from excited conversion to immediately the ministry with little theological training, but also with little arbitrary hindrances either. So you have kind of this, your strength is your weakness. Their strength is that they weren't tied down by arbitrary things. The problem is you have a lot of quick conversion to circuit preacher, creating the religion in that region. You essentially have a bishop on horseback in his 20s with congregations mostly of women, because they're staying at home while the frontier is pushed further out by the men. And so you have several different elements that you would recognize as a recipe for apostasy. And that's exactly what, as we're going to see in the story, occurs. Between 1713 and 1776, the American population had swelled from 360,000 to 3 million. And this was one case of what modern sociologists have called the vertical invasion of the barbarians. So consider this. Between 1713 and the year of independence, 1776, total population, 360,000 to over 3 million. Now that's significant, especially when the next generation predominantly is headed out west, and immediately their families are left here so they can go further out west. These untrained preachers are coming in and establishing churches in essentially non-Christian communities. Because the people that would go out there would be the ones that were more commercially minded, less connected with their church tradition. So you have immediately the seeds for a new kind of Christianity that get invented on the spot. Not, I'm sure, that they were intending to do this, but certainly the conditions for it were right there. But what do I mean, by the way, by that vertical invasion of the barbarians? Well, what that sociologist meant was that you have too many people arriving on the historic scene with too little traditional culture to soak them up. So the demand of need for culture far exceeds the supply of competent teachers, in this case, ministers, of the traditional orthodoxy. So, the old Puritan culture was no match for the influx of land speculators and their offspring, whose religious demand was a confused mixture now of Anglican, Catholic, and congregational platitudes. But a dollar of demand counts the same no matter the inherent worth of the product. Now, by the time the British surrendered at Yorktown, 1781, the theology of the Puritans represented a curious minority barely holding on to higher institutions scattered along the northeastern seaboard. European immigration had not shifted much away from the English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh, and German influx. There were also a 500,000 Africans in addition as a result of slavery, though there were other black freemen up north. So what did I just say, 500,000? So add to this number, 500,000, and we're going to see what happens with that demographic denominationally. Universities emerged. And this was a, you know, one historian called this middle-class democracy. And that's significant for religious development when it's all up for grabs. Middle-class democracy. If that has not existed before and it exists all at once, think of what that means. That amounted to a larger percentage of able people in a population possessing the ability to tell the church what religion is going to be like. You had a larger a burst of population that in their affluence and money and where churches were now going to be what that population says it's going to be, telling the church what church is going to be in a way that really rivals, I think even in a stronger way, what we have today. But this is the beginning of it, if this commercialistic, pragmatic religion. Universities emerged in every colony that were not meant to be mere seminaries now. The new nation's libraries and newspapers were independent of and often adversarial to those churches which had been the established church in each colony only years before. There were unifying ideas to the new people group, but these ideas were certainly not theological unities. These ideas were political and economic and would therefore take a demanding role over theology. And so Mark Knoll talks about what he calls the American Christian cultural synthesis. And what he means is that certain political virtues immediately turned into theological verities, to use his word. In other words, these things like democracy, consumerism, frontierism, primitivism, individualism become the centerpieces. They don't just become theological and color our theology in some nebulous way gradually. They become the center of theology on the frontier. It may be that there was an unaccountable liberalism at the heart of Puritan culture, which was foreign to the actual core of Puritan theology itself, but nevertheless is retained as the most precious part for the masses. These are the children of Puritans, remembering their parents' Puritanism, saying about the individual this versus the state this, and retaining only that. It begins in what one historian calls, quote, a pervasive antipathy to medievalism. What? Is that true about Puritanism? Yeah. A pervasive antipathy to medievalism against ceremonial pomp, moral profligacy, ostentatious indolence, and aristocratic privilege. So is Puritanism against all those things? It is. Yet, all of those can easily be mistaken for a mere bursting individualism. The rebellion proper to Puritanism in the untrained minds of this next generation, this groundswell of young barbarians, becomes sheer independence as an end in itself. And such human independence creeps toward the center of the religious universe, particularly when the church lacks the civic authority to suppress it. And I'm not saying, wouldn't it be great to go back to the days where this one religion in a colony or a state could just define what religion is? No, I don't want to go back to that at all. But it is worth noting. Sometimes I wonder when I read Knoll or Marston or people like that, if they're not saying, here's the problem, this religious liberty thing. It would be something, I don't know if they're saying that or not, but I'm certainly not. Now, no doubt, lamenting over that fact in the early decades turned a lot of reflective people into Roman Catholics, and certainly has since then. The lament for an immaterial authority with material teeth. At the time of independence, there was approximately 25,000 Catholics in the land, many of them, of course, in Maryland. But their better bet was in Canada, which was moving ever more to a British-type model, even as they were of French origin at the time, especially in Quebec. Catholicism was the way to go. But at any rate, most historians would concede to the clout of the eclipsing Puritan mind that though its body was dead, Puritanism as a whole, it was still powerful enough to launch a global revolution with its twitching feet. Or as one Puritan historian, Edmund Morgan, said it, the Puritan ethic, as it existed among the revolutionary generation, had in fact lost for most men the endorsement of an omnipresent angry God. The values and precepts derived from it, however, remained intact. In other words, the ethics of it. That's the part the kids remembered. And were reinforced by a reading of history that attributed the rise and fall of empires to the acquisition and loss of the same virtues God had demanded of the founders of New England. Just as one example, we ran into the name Ezra Stiles, who was at Yale in the Puritan culture, had to play the game of a Calvinist, but had criticized Edwards and the Awakening somewhat. He survives into the revolutionary generation, and he would write letters and words saying about the revolution, about God's providence, and surely this is God blessing his church even in America and evidence by all this. So he talked like a Calvinist would about these world events. But what he means is only ever something social, ethical. And that's the Puritanism that was retained. So it was possible to be kind of a I don't know, like a Puritan deist of sorts when it comes to religion. But then that God in some way is intervening. And then he explains that prayer by Franklin in the same era of his life that he's openly doubting the deity of Christ, nevertheless saying in Independence Hall, we should really pray. Let's not forget to pray because God intervenes and so on. So, you know, Jefferson and Franklin were both openly deist, which really didn't matter a whole lot where they came from. What mattered for them in a secular constitution was liberty of all spheres, not least the religious sphere. If Washington wished to be more overt in his faith, and he certainly ought to have done so, because many of his statements concerning the deity or nature's God or the supreme being are just that, things that really don't offend deists very much. Of the established churches, Connecticut's congregational monopoly lasted until 1818, and in Massachusetts, their state church lasted until 1833. Again, sort of a sidetrack, but just 9 of the 13 colonies had established religions, which is a significant clue that you're not reading the First Amendment right when you think that there's a wall of separation between church and state such that the states don't have any interest in religious matters. Now, there's a lot of other more basic problems with it, but it is worth noting that 9 of the 13 colonies had established religions. Certainly, the founders and the author in Madison's case, but the framers and the signers of that did not mean that the states couldn't do that. They meant that the Congress could not do that. Now, the argument was there, especially from the Baptists, to not do that at the state level either. But they did for another generation. So that's something a lot of people don't really realize. With the advent of civic-defined religion, and that being free religion, much of the reason for decline was simply that people felt the liberty to be left alone by the church as well. And so membership declined for that most obvious reason. People just got to a point where they really, in history, they oh, good, the church isn't going to be a big deal anymore. I can do what I always wanted to do anyway, which is not go to church. The writings of Thomas Paine caught on more after the Revolution. In one of his books, The Age of Reason, in 1794, he would popularize the notion of believing in God, but not the church. God I like, but not the Bible. Jesus, but not your Christians that call him God. Does any of this sound familiar? Long before the emergent church ever thought of it, Thomas Paine was saying it, and a lot of people were buying it. And the rationale is not much different. Now, Baptist churches caught on, especially in the South, because of the lack of restrictions there, and they were second only to the Methodists in their westward push. While the Anglican Church was now renamed Episcopal from the Greek word for bishop, episkopos. Naturally, the concept of a British-styled church wasn't going to play very well in the new nation that had just broken from Britain. But if one's tastes were for that middle way of Protestantism, then this was a way of dressing it up in a less offensive garb. Now, one reason that's important for the new demographic, well, because Episcopalian membership. So in this time, if you look at a pie chart, and that guy Shaw, his book, Revolutions, Churches, and Empires, he does a little pie chart. It's very helpful of basically the revolutionary generation. Let's just say 1776. I don't remember where he stops, 1830, 1840. But he shows where the group is in population then and where they are now. Sorry, he would do it like this for each group. And what you'll find is that Episcopalians and Presbyterians, you see this decline. But every other group, so Methodists are like this. They're down here, a couple thousand in the revolutionary generation, and boom, they're up here by 1830 and 1840. So especially Methodists, Baptists. Episcopalians are one group that go down, except for one demographic, and that is among Africans. And why would that be? Well, the English, as early as the revolutionary generation, they would use it as propaganda, were keen on the possibility of turning the large black population against their white oppressors. And all the more so once the slave trade was abolished in the mother country. This alleged moral superiority over the colonies was played upon in the churches, and black preachers were ordained with liberality for that very reason. And this is why there's so many black Episcopal churches to this day. Now, more often than not, these churches were a hybrid called the Methodist Episcopal Church. And so in inner cities everywhere throughout the country, a lot of the biggest black churches are Methodist Episcopal churches. And they became the first Christian group in the colonies to consistently call for the abolition of slavery, because the Methodists had consistently done that. In addition, according to Shaw, he said, quote, by 1800, there were some 25,000 African-American Baptists. So right away, the Methodists and the Baptists do a better job of criticizing slavery and pushing westward. And that tells you a lot about why the frontier looked the way it did religiously. Now, last point. There was in New England what has been called an Edwardsian school of theology that emphasized the rationale of doctrine and all of life in a way similar to the common sense realism coming out of Scotland and which was informing the founding fathers. Its principal architects were Jonathan Edwards Jr., who lived all the way to 1801, Samuel Hopkins, who I've already mentioned, who lived to 1803, and the aforementioned Timothy Dwight, so grandson of, through marriage to Timothy Dwight Sr., who lived through 1817. Now, this was called the New England theology, or the New Divinity. And it centered upon general revelation in a more rigid way than the senior Edwards would have done. It was kind of an evidential Calvinism. So, here's what we all have in common. Here's what we can all see in the world. God speaks in general revelation. He speaks in specific revelation. But the emphasis was on evidence. The concert of God's world with His Word. But here's the thing, in that emphasis, it downplayed the sovereignty of God and therefore the substitutionary atonement of Christ, because having disposed of British tyranny and British sovereignty, the more hands-off moral and governmental theory of the atonement made room for the common experience of mankind, something we all have in common. And this is a more useful function of the atonement in society, and accords with the truth of the Christian faith in a way that is more evidential to people. Now, Hopkins would become president of Yale in 1795, and Dwight would follow him in that post. And the heirs of Yale included Lyman Beecher and Nathaniel Taylor, and they at least saw themselves as the principal antagonists to the Unitarians up at Harvard. Because at Harvard, the swing toward Unitarianism was complete under William Channing, and his dates are 1780 to 1842. Now, there was nothing new in his thought. Doctrines like the Trinity and the Incarnation had to answer to reason, where it was believed they could not. So, same thing you would see in Michael Servetus or Socinius or any of those people. These doctrines are not in accord with reason. Now, the Unitarians of New England earnestly believed that they were the rightful heirs of the Puritan legacy. What made the tie that binds between the Puritan generation before and the new Puritanism was the morality. God was doing a moral work. He was doing a universal work. He was not separating mankind into these two tiers. He wasn't dividing history up by this two-tiered story with one side thrown away in damnation. He was doing a universal work, restoring the creation again. Does that sound familiar to the emergent church? The emergent church's theology was the dominant theology at the founding of the American Republic. And one of the most far-reaching products of this was the educational thinking of Horace Mann. We talked about it in the summer. He was a Unitarian who believed that he was a Puritan because of this universal moral work of God in society. No matter what the sect, each was defined by its stance against Calvinistic orthodoxy. And so it is instructive to note that American religion was defined from the beginning of the Republic, at least by a thought stream that was identical to almost everything at the heart of the emergent theology of the present day. And if that is true, then it would seem that their audience was already prepared for everything that they're saying for the past 200 years. So, next time, we're going to talk about a little bit about the frontier in between the two awakenings, and a little bit about good effects in Britain, like Wilberforce and the abolition of slavery, and some other seeds of revival going on in England and Scotland and Wales and so on. And that'll set us up for a topic that I'm going to talk about in the next 2 weeks called apostasy high and low. High apostasy meaning in the academic top of the stairs in Europe, beginnings of liberal theology, or as I'm going to call it, Kantianity, because how it comes from Kant and then Hegel, and then low, possibly low on the American frontier, Second Great Awakening, and all the cults that emerge from that. So that's going to be the next big chapter through the next few weeks, apostasy high and low. So, questions, comments, or anything else?